Morning.
Morning. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. The purchase and sale agreement...
Could you introduce yourself for the record?
Oh, sorry, Your Honor. Art Harrigan, representing the Griffiths appellants. The purchase and sale agreement expressly required a specific dock design to be attached, but none was. As a matter of law, specific performance cannot be awarded under these circumstances, especially on summary judgment. There were two addenda attached to the purchase and sale agreement 2 weeks apart. The sequence of events and of the language in those two addenda tells the story. We'll start with the first addendum, which was signed on June 6, 2012. It had a couple of provisions that are obviously very important. One is sellers agree to allow buyers to encroach into the normal 35-foot setback between, and then there was a strikeout, but at any rate, between docks. However, the degree to which encroachment within that 35 feet would be allowed was not specified. The first addendum also provided that the sellers hereby agree to assist buyers in their effort to obtain a dock permit. They agree not to challenge in any way the buyer's solicitation of any permit. That provision, like the 35-foot setback provision, were predicated on the later adoption of a specific dock design that would define what the sellers would agree to assist with and the extent of the allowable encroachment.
How do we know that?
Well, we know that because of the provisions in the second addendum and because of some advice that was given to the Sherbergs by their dock designer.
Doesn't the first addendum seem incredibly vague to support that argument, given the sophistication of the parties involved in this case?
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the second addendum, you'll see why
the second addendum doesn't exist at the time everybody's agreeing to the first addendum, so it doesn't really inform us much about their intent when they're signing the first addendum. And I have to tell you what struck me about this was I was surprised that someone would even sign the first addendum if they had the position your client does, because it would have been so easy to make it so much clearer, and these aren't people going to their first rodeo.
Well, Your Honor, I think you have to look at this contract as a whole, and the second addendum tells us what the plan was.
Doesn't necessarily tell us what the plan was at the time the first addendum was signed, because nobody had yet conceived the second addendum.
Your Honor, I think there are 2 points here. One is the first addendum says that some degree of encroachment within the 35 feet will be allowed, but not how much. Therefore, it is vague and essentially unenforceable on its face.
Well, you haven't sought to rescind the contract.
But, Your Honor, in fact, the second addendum was intended to answer that question, and it didn't happen. Now, on the day after the same day as the first addendum was signed, the Sherberg's dock designer said, we need a joint use agreement that, quote, allows us to be within 20 feet of their dock, or even better, 15, and also either remove the floating dock or get within 5 feet of it. He was saying that even though we've got this first addendum here, we need a joint use agreement that specifies how close we can come, and here's what we need. 2 weeks later, the second addendum is adopted. And it says, quote, seller further agrees to sign a joint use agreement as attached, which will allow the buyer to place the proposed dock within the 35-foot setback usually required. That is where the question that remained open in the first addendum was supposed to be answered. But there was no joint use agreement attached. There was no definition of how much intrusion within the 35 feet would be allowed.
But your client agreed that there would be a dock within the 35 feet without limit.
No, and there was no agreement to it without limit, Your Honor, because the second addendum says that we're going to agree on a specific, that we have agreed on a specific dock design. It is set forth in a joint use agreement, which is attached to this contract, and it's not attached. So that's part one, Your Honor, is that literally this contract expressly calls for a dock design, because there is the joint broker sent the Griffiths the Mercer Island Joint Use Agreement form, and that form says, spells out that there is an Exhibit C attached to it which has a specific dock design and location.
What are the consequences of Trier of Fact deciding there was no meeting of the minds with respect to what the dock would look like?
Then you don't get specific performance under the no reasonable doubt standard.
What do you get?
Well, Your Honor, we are in the same position that we were in fact in after the agreement was signed. Because what happened was that there was no agreement on a specific dock, but there had to be, which is why the parties...
Is that a material term to the underlying purchase and sale agreement? Does the transaction fail for vagueness?
The purchase and sale agreement doesn't fail, but the dock agreement fails.
Why isn't the right to have the dock an essential term of buying a waterfront property under the circumstances of this case?
No, Your Honor. Because... first of all, this property was advertised as a no-dock property. Then the Griffiths and the Sherberts...
Well, we know that wasn't how it was sold, though.
Well, Your Honor, but we're talking about the contract now. When you say, was it an essential term, the idea was that the price was agreed, the sale was agreed, and they were going to work out a deal on the dock. And they proceeded to attempt to do that. But for whatever reason, by the time they signed the second addendum, they hadn't reached a deal on the dock. And that yet, that second addendum expressly calls for a precise location and design, and there is none attached. So this, what we have is an incomplete, unenforceable contract. And
so
we don't even have to
ask the question, why did this sale close before there was an agreement about the dock?
Well, if we want to take a look at what Mr. Sherberg had to say about it, the day after the second addendum was signed, he said, I was under the impression they were going to remove the floating dock and move it elsewhere, because there were two ways this could work. One was that the Griffiths removed the floating dock. Now, that wasn't solve the whole problem, but it solved part of the problem. His expectation was the floating dock would be removed. Now, bear in mind that the
But you're going to tell me that Mr. Griffith never agreed to that, so there isn't a meeting of the minds on that term.
The expectation by Sherberg was that it would be removed. He had been told by his dock designer that it had to be removed, and when the second addendum was signed, Mr. Griffiths scratched out the provision that said he would remove the floating dock, which is why Mr. Sherberg was surprised the next day that he woke up and said, basically, I don't have a deal. He said, there are a couple of issues here. How close will he allow us to encroach? In other words, the problem set up by the first addendum of not specifying how far into the 35 feet you can go was supposed to be answered in the second addendum. It was not answered in the second addendum. And when Mr. Sherberg realized that the floating dock removal provision had been stricken, he knew he had no deal. Because
he
knew that...
He signed it, though.
I beg your pardon?
He signed it.
Yes, apparently he signed it, yes. But in fact, it's an incomplete contract.
Okay, you'll have 2 minutes, and we're still scratching our heads about why a rescission isn't the appropriate remedy.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll think about that prior to my next
That's last That's why I
minutes.
Said what I did.
Good morning. I'm Todd Buck on behalf of the Sherbergs. This is a plain contract. I believe, Judge Leach, that your question goes right to the heart of the matter. Why would somebody with the sophistication of Hal Griffith, who has signed thousands of contracts in his lifetime, contracts with millions or hundreds of millions of dollars at stake, sign something that was so plain if he didn't agree to it? And we have a tendency in this case to jump past that fundamental issue. What is this contract? What are the obligations that are built into this contract? And the obligations are very straightforward. The first addendum has five. You will assist in obtaining a dock permit. Two, you will not challenge in any way the pursuit of the dock permit. Three, you will allow them to encroach within 35 feet that would normally be the setback.
So it could be adjoining.
I'm sorry?
It could be adjoining. Even though they bought the property and went through the process of divesting the owner of what became your lot of any interest in their dock, your reading of these documents is that your client could then build a dock that was adjoining, that literally was like a common wall.
Actually, yes, Your Honor, because the fourth requirement is that the easement may need to be changed, The fifth is that they will cooperate in building a dock along the western property line, which is exactly where the Griffiths dock
is. When we look at this, what we're seeing is that from all of the facts and circumstances, we look at this, and what happened was that the Griffiths entered into a contract, notwithstanding all of these things that happened before, whereby they ended up in a worse position than when they started, before they bought the neighbor's lot, before they went through the reservation of interest, all of that. That's what they intended to do.
Right. Well, where the Griffiths ended up is in a position where all of a sudden there was a permitted dock that they didn't believe could ever be permitted, and I believe that's the answer to your question.
Well, no. Where they ended up was where you could build a dock that's literally adjoining. So after going through all of the cost and expense of excluding anyone else using their dock,
yes,
and having access to their dock from both sides and being the kings of the dock on this part of Lake Washington, they bargained for a circumstance where they sold back the property that they purchased and then allowed for another dock to be built right next to it, within an inch, within an eighth of an inch.
Within 35 feet, Your Honor. They claimed
that's
that
within an eighth of an inch, right?
I completely agree.
It's an eighth of an inch is within 35 feet, right?
I completely agree.
Okay.
And what they thought ahead of time, what their unilateral or unexpressed intention was with regard to that, has nothing to do with the interpretation of this contract.
Was it an unexpressed intention when they sold the lot as a no-dock lot?
It was an unexpressed intention with regard to the contract that is signed by the Griffiths, which says that they will not contest the permit design in any way, and they will allow it within the 35-foot setback. The term within is not an unusual term. It's a common term. Let me put it into a different context.
Let me go back to Judge Dwyer's question for a second. Does it make sense if you have been bargaining with someone who has negotiated the right to maintain the property along the lake by their dock and to tell you that you can't use their dock to have intended to allow something that would really deprive them of what all of those prior activities that you're aware of were intended to gain them?
Your Honor, again, they may not have believed that that was what was going to be the end result.
This is more than an unexpressed unilateral intention when the other side is aware that they've retained these easement rights and have eliminated the joint dock agreement. I mean, both sides are aware of these facts, aren't they?
They are aware of this, Your Honor, but I respectfully suggest that this is exactly what the Supreme Court dealt with in the Hirsch case, where there was ample extrinsic evidence that both sides had said that two newspapers is what we want, and that there was a reason to suggest the loss clause that ended up with the PI going out of business was not what it's supposed to have said. And the Supreme Court said, it doesn't matter what you all talked about, it doesn't matter what you knew or what you said, it matters what is written in the contract. And what is written in this contract is so incredibly simple and clear that it is beyond reproach. Within means, as Judge Dwyer has noted, 0 to 35.
But having a sketch provided by your architect showing a distance of 23 feet away from their dock, isn't that part of the contract too, isn't it?
It is not, Your Honor. All it is an acknowledgement of a sketch which was going to be the foundation of the permitting process. If you look at the language of the contract, it is abundantly clear what's going to happen is the Cherbourgs are going to pursue a permitted dock. Now, everybody knows that when you go for a permit, what you want is not necessarily what's going to come out of the permit process, which goes directly to the Exhibit C argument that counsel is making. Exhibit C in the joint use agreement is the permitted dock. It could not be attached at the time of the addendum because unless you have a time machine and you can go forward and secure a copy of the ultimate permitted dock, you can't attach it to the JUA. The JUA is there once the permit is ready for the neighbor to say, I agree with this. Every argument the Griffiths make come back to this fundamental error. They claim that they had the right to object to the location or the size or the scope of the dock. They specifically bargained away that right.
Do you agree that the right to have a dock was a material term to this transaction?
I believe it was a material term, Your Honor. I don't know how you could read the addendum as anything other than that. when parties go to the effort to make such an extreme statement of obligation as that you will take no action to challenge the permitting process, that is obviously of paramount importance in a material term.
Well, the reason I ask that question, does that mean that really the two choices for a result here are either there wasn't a meeting of the minds and there was no contract between the parties, or there was the contract that you have described to us? So are those the two choices?
Well, I would suggest that there isn't any foundation to say there's no meeting of the minds because, again, the contract is abundantly
clear. Well, that's why you've got your choice. There's a meeting of the minds, and this is it. Is the other choice there is no meeting of the minds, or is there a third somewhere in between choice? I'm having a hard time seeing where that third choice is.
I don't know that there's a third choice, Your Honor. I don't know that there is. If you look at the other areas of suggested ambiguity that have been raised by the Griffiths in this case, the language about allowing, signing the JUA in order to allow the dock to go there, they've argued that that means that the parties intended that the Griffiths would be allowing the dock to go there. No. The Griffiths signed away the right to object to that. They had already agreed to allow the dock within the 35-foot setback. Read in context, there's only one sensible explanation for that statement. The JUA is required by the city in order for the dock to be within the otherwise 35-foot setback. You can't strip the context of that statement out and ignore the earlier comment, the earlier agreement, that they'd already said it's okay to be within that 35 feet. They'd already signed that agreement. The new dock issue, Judge Mann, I think is an important one because there's a lot of the term perfidious was used in the brief, which one doesn't see very often around here, but the question is whether or not the dock designer had done something which altered the Corps of Engineers process. Mr. Burns did nothing but tell the truth. He told the Corps that the Griffiths had agreed to the position of the dock. The Griffiths had agreed to the position of the dock by expressly contracting away their right to object. I noted that the second addendum doesn't say we agree to this dock as the one that would be sought for permitting processes. All the second amendments or the second addendum says is that the seller acknowledges receipt of the new dock, which is going to be the foundation for the dock to be pursued through the permitting process. Nothing that Mr. Burns said is contrary to the facts of this case. In fact, when you look at the last complaint raised by the Griffiths about Mr. Burns' conduct, which is a hearsay within hearsay statement from the Corps of Engineers, that Griffiths isn't going to sign the JUA anyway. Well, that was absolutely accurate. They had refused to sign the JUA over iteration after iteration after iteration, with the Cherbergs trying desperately to not be here, to be neighbors, to get them to simply sign off on what they'd already agreed on so that we wouldn't have to be in this kind of a situation. When a contract has such blatantly clear terms, and when the parties are as sophisticated as these parties are, I would suggest, gentlemen, that this court should uphold that contract. Because otherwise, whoever has the most money and can pursue the appeal longest is going to win. And that's not the way our system is supposed to work.
Thank you.
Your Honor, the third choice is what actually occurred, and that is that for the better part of a year, the parties attempted to agree on a specific dock because they both knew that there was no such agreement under the existing contract.
And they haven't been able to do that as we stand here today, have they?
Well, Your Honor, what happened was that Mr. Cherberg abandoned the effort and submitted a undisclosed application of the Corps of Engineers for a far larger dock than anything that
would you agree there discussed. Hasn't been any agreement as to a dock between the Cherbergs and the Griffiths?
Yes.
And so then if having a dock is an essential term of this agreement, why is there a meeting of the minds?
There may not have been a meeting of the minds. In fact, there was no meeting of the minds on the dock. That's clear. And what the Cherbergs then did, and we're talking here about an equitable remedy, is when the Corps of Engineers specifically asked, does Mr. Griffith have any objection to this dock? Dr. Sherberg wrote a response to be given by his dock designer, Burns, stating that he had approved it in the purchase and sale agreement when the design that was before the Corps of Engineers didn't resemble anything that was drawn or existing at the time of the purchase and sale agreement. And that is how they got a Corps of Engineers permit. And, of course, their argument is, for which there is no basis at all, that the Griffiths agreed to allow any dock for which they could get a permit, which, by the way, is something that was invented after the complaint was filed in this case. If you read the complaint, it says the dock, the dock that was attached to the purchase and sale agreement. In other words, they thought that one up after the litigation started. But the fact is that the Corps of Engineers would never have issued this permit had they not been told erroneously that the Griffiths had actually approved this dock, which absolutely is not the case. So under their theory, the condition under which the Griffiths would be obligated was created by their misrepresentations to the Corps of Engineers.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Judge Leach, I think I misinterpreted one of your questions. May I just briefly address that?
No. If you want to send me a letter, you can feel free to do that. We're not going to have any more oral argument.
I appreciate it.
Our next case this morning.